I'm Earlonne Woods.
I'm Nigel Poor. We're the hosts and creators of Ear Hustle from PRX's Radiotopia.
Ear Hustle is a show about life inside prison, but it's not your typical prison podcast.
In this next season, we've got stories about the objects people keep inside their prison cells.
About residents in a women's prison who say they want to stay there.
And the most beautiful prison garden. Earlonne, I will never forget it.
Ear Hustle. Stories about life on the inside, told by those who live it.
Find Ear Hustle wherever you get your podcasts.
You love free, and at Ameris Bank, so do we. That's why we're proud to offer worry-free, hassle-free Ameris Bank free checking. Manage your money your way with convenient access to digital, mobile, and telephone banking, all with no monthly service fee or minimum balance requirements. At Ameris Bank, we're with you. For more information or to open an account, visit our local bankers in person or online at amerisbank.com/free checking. Other fees such as overdraft fees may apply. Ameris Bank, member FDIC, equal housing lender.
This is Buried Truths. I'm Hank Klibanoff. The stunning verdict is in. The coroner's jury has declared unanimously and unequivocally the shooting of A.C. Hall was murder. The white officers who shot him, Josh T. Brown and James Larry Durden, have been taken to jail. Their attorney, Denmark Groover, quickly petitioned the court for a hearing. And here's what he said. The ends of justice require the two men be released on bail. Well, that hearing took place 4 days after Brown and Durden went to the county lockup and 10 days after they shot A.C. Hall. It was unusual for murder suspects to be granted bond, but you have to consider the time and the place, Macon, Georgia, 1962. Elements of the white community were agitating for Brown and Durden's release. They were even raising money. Now, at the bond hearing, Denmark Groover made an uncharacteristic misstep. Here's what he said. At the very most, they are guilty of manslaughter, not of murder. Then, apparently realizing he had just accused his clients of a serious crime, Groover took it back. They weren't guilty of anything, he said. Perhaps sensing the prevailing public opinion, that is, the white public opinion, the judge set bond at $3,000 apiece, the equivalent of about $25,000 today. A local doctor and a local grocer signed the bonds, and the officers were released. Now that they were out of jail, the question was, would they ever go back in? The autumn of 1962 was a season of tension in the United States. The U.S. was packing more and more young men onto aircraft headed to South Vietnam. At the start of the year, 3,200 Americans were there. By late fall, that number had more than tripled. The national midterm elections were coming, that moment in November when the politics of the nation could change overnight. James Meredith, the first black student to enroll at the University of Mississippi, was deep into his first semester there. At every step, he was accompanied by a federal marshal. The nation, meanwhile, had just spent nearly half of October on the brink of nuclear annihilation. U.S. spy planes had caught the Soviet Union sneaking nuclear missiles into Cuba. And even as Americans prepared for the end of the world, President Kennedy waged and ultimately won the greatest stare down in U.S. history. The coroner's jury may have found that Brown and Durden committed murder, but the two were already out of jail. And momentous as it was, the coroner's jury verdict had little more than moral authority. Now, the grand jury hearing, that would be the main event. The grand jury had powers the coroner's jury didn't have, starting with the authority to bring criminal charges against the two. Now, this part of the criminal justice system, the grand jury part, is frankly opaque. So I'm going to talk for a minute about this. The first thing to know about grand juries is they're grand, large. In Georgia, up to 23 citizens plus alternates are allowed to hear criminal cases. The jury that we're most familiar with, 12 people who decide guilt or innocence in a trial, is known as a petit jury. You know, petite, small. Now, the big difference between a grand jury and a regular trial jury? The grand jury decides whether there's enough evidence to send the defendant to trial. And the trial jury decides whether there's enough evidence to send him to prison. Well, why even have a grand jury? Well, to protect people from the state. Look at it this way. The prosecutor is the state with all of its awesome powers. The grand jury represents the people, and the people have a stake in keeping the state's awesome power in check. This training video for federal grand juries puts it this way.
You can think of a grand jury as a shield against unjust prosecution. Among other things, a grand jury is supposed to make sure that if there is no evidence, a person will not be accused of a crime.
States that use grand juries have their own laws and procedures for them, how they're run, who's allowed inside, how evidence and witnesses are presented. But they all have this in common. The grand jury is a mysterious place. The prosecutor runs the whole thing. Typically, the defendant and his lawyer are not even allowed to attend. So why is it mysterious? Because the proceedings are secret. And why is that? Well, a couple of reasons. One is fairness. In a trial, the judge, applying strict rules of evidence, decides which testimony and evidence the jury will hear. There's no such rule in the grand jury. There's not even a judge. The prosecutor can put whatever he or she wants before the grand jury. Another reason for secrecy? To protect witnesses. Think mobs, drug cartels, gangs. Grand jury testimony can bring down a big-time drug lord. And it can also get a witness killed. There's also a downside to secrecy. We don't know whether the prosecutor's doing a good job. Perhaps he's easing up on someone who's clearly guilty, or bearing down on someone who is clearly innocent. The district attorney has enormous latitude in that regard. The grand juries are supposed to be a check on that. But are they? Under our system, we can only hope so, but we can't know for sure because it's a secret. Now, you've heard many times about indictments. It's an interesting word, indict. It comes from the Latin for proclaim or pronounce. Indictments often result in great big headlines. Network news announcers can get a little breathless when it comes to reporting on an indictment.
The first indictment from special counsel.
A grand jury in Chicago has reportedly indicted the Empire.
California Representative Duncan Hunter and Margaret Hunter were indicted yesterday, charged
now
with...
Now he is indicted on seven counts, one count of obstruction of an official...
Here's how an indictment comes about. The prosecutor draws up what's called a bill of indictment and takes it before the grand jury. The prosecutor then calls witnesses and offers testimony. If the grand jury agrees that the suspect is likely to have committed the crime, it signs the bill of indictment. It becomes what's known as a true bill, and it means the case goes to trial. Now, if the grand jury doesn't believe the prosecutor has made his case, then it votes against the bill of indictment, and it becomes a no bill, and the suspect is in the clear. So, true bill, you're going to trial. No bill, you're going home. Although most of the grand jury records are secret, the names of the grand jurors are not. Well, our researcher, Catherine Dautrick, tracked down information on all 21 grand jurors in the A.C. Hall case. she found that only one of them is still alive, 91-year-old Thomas Alexander. Well, that news certainly got me juiced. I mean, one chance, almost certainly the last and only chance, to learn what happened inside the A.C. Hall grand jury room. But Mr. Alexander told his daughters he just didn't recall that grand jury. He'd been on a number of trial juries and grand juries in the past. But now, 50 or 60 years later, it was tough to remember the details.
I haven't been on a lot of grand juries, but I've been on maybe at least three, but I can't remember which ones they were. So I can't remember.
Mr. Alexander had a generous spirit and said he was willing to meet and allow me to try to jog his memory. So I showed up with a lot of photographs of the principal people in the case. During an hour, filled with comfortable small talk, he told me he remembered both the prosecutor, Jack Gautier, and the defense attorney, Denmark Groover, who he knew as Denny. But he knew them from church or from the neighborhood or as community figures, not from the A.C. Hall grand jury. I asked him whether he recognized the names of the police officers. No. Since a black lawyer in a courtroom in Georgia was still a strange sight, I showed him photographs of Howard Moore and Donald Hollowell from the early 1960s. Hollowell's name rang a bell, but that triggered no memory. Did he recall a case in which an important witness was a 16-year-old girl, a black girl, Eloise Franklin? Still, no. There was one moment in my conversation with Mr. Alexander when I felt my pulse race. I asked him, what about the medical examiner, Leonard Campbell? Well, Mr. Alexander said yes. He remembered Campbell being in the courtroom. But that's as far as he went, or as far as he could go.
You know, you'd think that that case would have been something I would remember, but it really and truly is not.
Right.
I was grateful to meet Mr. Alexander, and I enjoyed our time, but I was so disappointed. So in trying to figure out what happened inside the grand jury hearing, I'm left with just some educated guesses. First, as you'll recall, in the inquest, Brown and Durden were able to sit in the entire proceeding and hear all the testimony against them. And then they got to make the concluding statements without being sworn in and without being cross-examined. That same privilege extended into the grand jury. So it seems somewhere between possible and certain that Brown and Durden, shaken by the coroner's jury verdict, took everything they and the Hopper said at the inquest, every conflict, every contradiction in their testimonies, and smoothed it all out for the grand jurors. Now, perhaps the top prosecutor just wasn't interested in bringing charges. Perhaps, like many police officers who are investigated by a grand jury, Brown and Durden both shed a tear during their statements and swayed the jurors. We don't know what sort of arguments or evidence the DA offered. We only know this. The grand jurors returned a no bill. With that, the matter of A.C. Hall was closed. His death was marked down as a lawful shooting by Macon police. Brown and Durden not only went free, their suspensions were lifted, and they rejoined the police force. But these facts remain. A.C. Hall was unarmed. A.C. Hall did not steal the Hopper's gun. And A.C. Hall was shot in the back.
Support for WABE's local coverage on maternal health and mortality comes from Georgia Health Initiative, whose mission is to inspire and promote collective action that advances health equity for all Georgians. Learn more at GeorgiaHealthInitiative.org.
Support for WABE comes from 100 Miles, a nonprofit committed to preserving Georgia's 100-mile coast. Protecting this critical coastal ecosystem takes all of us. Watch the stories of the innovators and future leaders who help keep our coast flowing at ourgeorgiacoast.org.
If Atlanta civil rights attorney Howard Moore was surprised by the coroner's jury, he was not at all surprised by the grand jury.
The coroner's inquest verdict is an anomaly in the way things were practiced at that time. I think if you probably go through 1,000 cases of shootings, you won't find another coroner's inquest involving white officers who shot an African American was guilty of murder. This is extraordinary.
Macon's black community was outraged by the grand jury's decision. Hundreds of people signed a petition to the all-white Macon City Council demanding that Brown and Durden be dismissed from the force. About 100 black residents marched the petition into a city council meeting. The council took a vote. One member voted to fire the officers. 12 members voted not to. Another member then proposed that Brown and Durden's records include a note that the officers had killed A.C. Hall. Well, that measure won only 2 votes. So at the city council, this matter was over. Shortly after the grand jury declined to indict the officers, the NAACP in Macon kicked off a boycott of white stores right at the beginning of the Christmas season. Black residents, it was said, would wear old clothes with new dignity. Earlier that year, you may recall, William P. Randall had led the Macon bus boycott.
We will never stop in Macon until Macon is the best place to live in Georgia.
Now, in November, Randall was back at it, organizing a new call for action. Randall spoke to roughly 800 people who packed Beulah Baptist Church. And he said to them that the men of the grand jury, in his words, who refused the other day to indict those cops, knew, too, that it was murder. Dozens of protesters picketed downtown. And as part of the boycott of white-owned stores, the picketers demanded that store owners hire more black employees in positions other than janitor. Some white store owners hung signs that said, "We reserve the right to refuse service to anyone. White customers preferred." But not everyone felt that way. Some white residents felt greater sympathy for the black community. Remember the Hurwitz family? The family that employed A.C. Hall's mother, Curly Hall? Well, here's Jan Hurwitz Mann, who was 15 years old when A.C. Hall was killed, and she's recalling the reaction in her family.
I remember it was so shocking that my father got so involved with the NAACP at the time because he was so incensed by the whole thing.
Even reporter Trezvant Anderson with the black newspaper, the Pittsburgh Courier, noted that some white merchants were embarrassed by the whole business, and some did hire a few black employees. There was no justice for A.C. Hall in Macon in 1962. But 50 years later, another chance emerged in 2006. That was when the U.S. Department of Justice reopened the A.C. Hall shooting. This was part of their cold case initiative, in which the FBI took a fresh look at apparent cases of racially motivated killings before 1969. The cold case initiative gave a measure of hope to a lot of people, people who lost loved ones to racist killings decades earlier. Would the perpetrators of those crimes, at long last, be held responsible? The Attorney General of the United States at the time, Alberto Gonzalez, and FBI Director Robert Mueller announced the initiative, Gonzalez issued a very stern warning.
And to those individuals who committed these crimes and who have lived with their guilty consciences for these many years, our message should be clear. You have not gotten away with anything. We are still on your trail.
Gonzalez and Mueller released a list of more than 100 victims, and A.C. Hall's name was on it. Unfortunately, the Justice Department's handling of the Hall shooting makes you wonder whether the government was serious about solving those cases. Gonzalez explained that the FBI was starting out in the hole. He said agents would discover that evidence had been lost or destroyed, that all leads were cold, that key witnesses or suspects had died. And that was true, but not in the case of A.C. Hall. When the federal initiative got off the ground in early 2007, the two police officers, James Larry Durden and Josh T. Brown, were still alive. So were the Hoppers. But journalists and lawyers pursuing civil rights cold cases observed that the FBI didn't seem to be acting with a whole lot of urgency on these cases. Even Eloise Franklin lived another 5 years after the FBI initiative was announced, but we found no indication that agents ever spoke with her. Officer Durden lived another 2 years after the FBI initiative was announced, and here, too, we found no indication the FBI ever spoke with him. Now, the FBI did talk with the Hoppers and Officer Brown in 2011, and not long after that, the Justice Department issued a report. Now, I want to tell you, I've seen a range of Justice Department and FBI reports and explanations for why they couldn't successfully prosecute some of these old civil rights cold cases. But this is the strangest one I've seen. Their conclusion, and I quote, "Although Brown could not remember many of the details of the incident, he gave an account consistent with his 1962 statement." Wait. So what they're saying is that since he had the same alibi in 2011 that he had in 1962, well, then he must be telling the truth. But did Brown say the same thing both times? You tell me. When I did a Freedom of Information Act request of all the records that the Justice Department held on the A.C. Hall case, all they had was the transcript of the coroner's inquest. But get this. According to the 2011 report, Brown told investigators that he actually saw a gun in A.C. Hall's hand. Now, no one, not Brown or Durden, not the Hoppers, no one had ever said in the 1962 inquest that there was anything in A.C. Hall's hand. Now, you yourself know that because you've been hearing the inquest testimony. And in the transcript of that inquest, no witness ever said they saw a gun in the hand of A.C. Hall. So what that means is that the Justice Department attorneys either did not read their own records, that is, the transcript, or failed to see the obvious contradiction between what Brown said in 1962 and what he said 5 years before he died. I know what you're thinking. There were enough inconsistencies that the FBI had to reopen the case in 2011, right? Well, the feds didn't see it that way. Instead, they filed a letter saying that Durden was dead and could not be prosecuted. Brown, they said, had essentially told the same story in 2011 as in 1962 and was therefore believable. When the FBI got involved in 2011, they also questioned Doris and Barnett Hopper. Those accounts also bore no resemblance to the testimony the Hoppers had given in 1962. Well, yes, their memories may have failed some 50 years later, but they didn't just say, "I don't remember." According to the FBI, they said things that directly contradicted what they'd said before. And here's the biggest discrepancy. In the 1962 testimony, Barnett Hopper said he saw A.C. Hall turn toward them and make a threatening move, and that the officers then opened fire on the teenager from the car. But in 2011, the story changed, and now it was this. Both officers exited the vehicle and chased A.C. Hall on foot. All three had disappeared from view, he said, when the couple heard a single gunshot.
Getting the smile and confidence you've been dreaming about, all from the comfort of your home, isn't a total mystery with Byte Clear Aligners. Just don't be surprised if all your friends start asking, "What's your secret?" Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. Byte Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Delve into the shadows of the mind with Sleeping Dogs, a gripping murder mystery starring Academy Award winner Russell Crowe. Now available on digital. Crowe portrays an ex-homicide detective unraveling a brutal murder he can't recall. Uncovering secrets from his past, he learns a chilling truth. It's best to let sleeping dogs lie. Visit sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery to watch Sleeping Dogs, now on digital. That's sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery.
As of 2019, A.C. Hall has been dead almost 57 years. A.C.'s mother, Curly Hall, has long since passed away. Eloise Franklin is dead. Donnelly Hollowell, A.R. King Jr., all five men on the coroner's jury, all dead and gone. Each in his or her own way tried to find justice for A.C. Hall. But justice eluded them all. And A.C. Hall's case is closed yet again. One of the most remarkable characters in our story, of course, is Eloise Franklin, the 16-year-old African-American held her own on the stand amid a crowd of white people. What became of her? Well, my students and I have tried hard to find the imprint that she left on Macon. I told you back in an earlier episode about Tom Duvall. He's the retired black dentist who even today celebrates the heroic bus boycott of 1962. Our finest hour, he called it. Well, one day, my students and I are at the Washington Memorial Library in Macon, there to meet Tom Duvall. So we're throwing a bunch of names at him of people from the past and from the A.C. Hall case. And when we mentioned the name Eloise Franklin, his eyes rose. "Well," he said, "that's my sister-in-law. She married my brother, Billy." Tom remembers Eloise Franklin, his sister-in-law, as smart and independent.
She was an attractive young lady. She had high self-esteem and so forth. And just because she didn't have a college degree doesn't mean she wasn't sharp.
My students, Leah Howard and Sandra Aguilera, interviewed Eloise Franklin's husband, Billy Duvall, in late 2016 as part of our Georgia Civil Rights Cold Cases class at Emory. Billy Duvall said Eloise had found work as a waitress at the best-known restaurant in Macon, the sprawling S&S Cafeteria. He agrees with his brother that she had considerable self-esteem.
She was a real, real outgoing person. She was real pleasant. She had a nice personality. She was outgoing. But she was a good-looking woman. And she had a whole lot of men that were, that were after her, be talking to her, or want to talk to her. She kind of had a head. a little attitude about it. And she always cared about the way she looked, dressed, and everything.
Billy Duvall told the students that he and Eloise started going out in the early 1980s, and wound up getting married. Eloise would have been in her mid-30s by then. Duvall knew Eloise had been part of a frightening incident with a teenage boy and police back in the day, but she didn't like to talk about it. She even once told him that police had forbidden her to talk about it, and he didn't bring it up. One exception, when Billy and Eloise drove past the George Washington Carver School.
I think we drove past that place once or twice. And she would point over there where that place was, point over where that area was, where that guy got shot. And she told me about this guy running, and she had sort of, you know, come on, go with her, come on, run with it, but she wouldn't do it. She really didn't want to go into any detail about that, because she was real quiet, and I noticed her attitude and her personality—it all changed. It just seemed like she didn't want to talk about it. You know?
It did take a lot to get Eloise talking about the night AC died. Ollie Mae Hutchins was Eloise's neighbor many years after the shooting. You may recall Miss Hutchins from earlier in the podcast. She and Eloise used to have a little nip on the front porch from time to time.
She said they were just walking and holding hands and. They didn't do it because she was with him, so...
So Eloise says she was with him the whole time?
Yeah. And she kept telling him he didn't have no gun, you know?
I told her that police brought a gun to the inquest and that the man whose gun was stolen said, "That's not my gun." She then expressed the same conclusion that maybe you yourself have reached.
So they killed him for no reason.
We'd been trying for some time to reach Eloise Franklin's children. There were three, a boy, a girl, another boy, now all grown. My students and I were so impressed by Eloise's poise, her composure, her steadfastness through every spin cycle of adversity in this story. So we wanted to learn more. We figured they knew her best, and we really wanted to hear from them. I'm going to tell you how that went, but in the interest of privacy, I also need to tell you that you're not going to hear their names here. We found Eloise Franklin's daughter easily enough. She lives in Georgia, and I reached her by phone. I began explaining who I was, about the course that I teach, but I didn't get very far. She was quick to express concern, even worry. She said she didn't want anyone besmirching her mother's name. Well, I assured her that we thought her mother, as a 16-year-old being hit left and right with 230 questions at the inquest, conducted herself with great dignity. Well, my students were in awe of her mother. So the daughter became calmer, and she said she wanted to gather records about the A.C. Hall case and talk with her older brother before meeting with me. Later, purely by coincidence, I ran into her in Macon as she was looking for records. She said her brother had agreed that she should talk with us and that she would after she read more about the case. Sadly, despite our numerous overtures, she never took or returned our calls or letters. And we've not talked since. We tried in earnest to reach both brothers, especially the older brother, living today in San Diego. We had probably a dozen telephone numbers for him, and everything we tried evaporated into the ether. I really do want to talk to one of these children. So far, they haven't reached out to us. In the search process, we did bring in an investigative reporter. Though he couldn't find the older son, he did find a longtime former girlfriend. Well, what were we after? Well, a greater understanding of Eloise Franklin. So my producer, Dave Barriswain, called her up. And sure enough, she knew Eloise Franklin well.
She was very, very smart. She was a hard-working, when I say beautiful, she was beautiful.
Her name Sonia. She had, in the past, dated Eloise's firstborn son for 10 years. During that time, she said she'd come to know Eloise Franklin very well. She recalled the time Eloise came out west to see them in or around 2003. By then, Eloise was in her 60s, and she was terminally ill.
She came to California, and she shared with me that she was dying. I was swore to secrecy.
Sonia recalls a tender moment when she and Eloise's older son flew to Macon for what would turn out to be Eloise's last birthday.
We had a fish fry, and we just hung out in her yard all that day with her. We got her dressed, and it was a cold day. I had a real connection with her. And she sat up and hung out all day long with us. And then we put her back to bed, and we flew back to California. But when we were leaving, I said, look, babe, we're going to do a turnaround because she's not going to be here too much longer.
And she wasn't. Eloise Franklin died in 2012. When Eloise Franklin had traveled to visit her son and Sonia in California, she gave him an envelope with newspaper clippings about a story from her past.
When she came to California to visit, she brought every piece of information that she had that had happened to her. She gave him that and said, this is something that you need to read and that you need to know.
The clippings were about the killing of A.C. Hall. Why was Eloise telling her son about A.C. Hall? Well, you might be thinking, was A.C. his father? I have to tell you, we've wondered that too. So let me tell you what Sonia said. Sonia believes, emphatically, that her former boyfriend is A.C. Hall's son. And she believes that's the message Eloise Franklin was sending him when she gave him the newspaper clippings about A.C. Hall's death. So we looked into it. Georgia regulations won't let me see the birth certificate of Eloise Franklin's oldest son without his permission. But every other court record and every other document that we've seen that he has signed place his birth date in the fall of 1965, 3 years after A.C. Hall was killed. 3 years. A news story, as well as his high school yearbook, show that he graduated in 1984. Which is appropriate for someone born in 1965. But that's too young to be the child of A.C. Hall. So what was Eloise's purpose in providing her son the newspaper clippings? Well, it's because she was trying to explain a life-changing decision she had made decades earlier. Do you remember when I first told you about Eloise Franklin? When she was out on that date with A.C. Hall. That's when we shared this song by Otis Redding.
These arms are mine. They are lonely.
We supposed it was the song that might have been playing in the Middle Georgia Veterans Club that night on Cotton Avenue. And we think it might be appropriate here at this point as well. Because from all of our research, we were able to find out something else. In the aftermath of the shooting, the Tyndall Heights community, some of the neighbors, and the women of the church kept a watchful eye out for A.C. Hall's mother, Curly Hall. They noticed a major development in her life. Eloise Franklin, who had been away from Macon for a period of time, was back in town. And one day, she showed up at Curly Hall's house, and she was not alone. Now, I don't know exactly how it happened, but I can see this. Eloise stood at the doorstep. Through tears, she handed a child to Curly Hall. It was Eloise Franklin's first child, a boy. What we now know is this. Eloise Franklin gave this boy to Curly Hall, who had lost her only son. She gave him to Curly Hall to now raise as her own. And those newspaper clippings? Well, now they made even more sense. According to Sonia, Eloise wanted her son to have more clarity about why Curly Hall raised him and why she did not.
And Miss Eloise always played a part in the upbringing of him with Miss Curly. She did a very good job. And he loved his grandmother.
And I gotta say, Eloise's first son as A.C. Hall's child, yeah, I mean, that would be a great, warm, and wonderful Hollywood ending, wouldn't it? But from what we know, it's very unlikely. But in the end, what does it really matter? I mean, I'm no less moved. And that life-changing decision that Eloise had made decades earlier, well, it was to give her firstborn a happy home where he would clearly be loved. And Curly Hall didn't do it alone. Some of the neighbors of Tyndall Heights helped raise the boy, teaching him how to work on cars and motorcycles, how to be respectful to others. Curly Hall, whom he called his grandmother, would show him how to work in the garden.
He showed me where their garden was across the street, where they planted watermelons, and it rained so hard that his watermelons were washing down the river. And he was out there hollering, telling his grandma, "Grandma, my watermelons, they're floating away."
Eloise's son would grow up, graduate from high school, and join the Marines. Now, after years of exploring with my students the life and times of A.C. Hall and Eloise Franklin, I can say with a full heart that I agree with Sonia's explanation of the gesture Eloise was making to Curly Hall.
It was a gift to her.
Next in the season finale of Buried Truths, the death of A.C. Hall is a difficult tale to tell. Police shootings are still common today, but we'll also look at how things have improved.
Hey, this is what we were working for in the 60s, all right?
And my students and I return to Macon, to A.C. Hall's gravesite, for final thoughts that I found inspiring.
So today, this morning, we went to the grave of A.C. Hall. Surprisingly, I actually did feel pretty emotional about it.
That's next time on the season finale of Buried Truths.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause. And rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
Have you donated to WABE yet? I know you've heard us talking about why it's important, but it doesn't have to be this big decision. You can give at whatever amount fits your budget. It can be a spur-of-the-moment thing. You already get so much out of public radio, so just go for it. Visit wabe.org/donate and become a member right now. And thank you.
Buried Truths is a production of WABE Atlanta. There are a lot of ways you can get more connected to the work we're doing. Sign up for our newsletter at wabe.org/buriedtruths. You'll get historic photos, documents, and more info about the case. Bring Buried Truths into the classroom by downloading lesson plans for middle and high school students, and follow us on social media. We're at Buried Truths Podcast. And of course, as always, please subscribe if you haven't already and leave us a review. It'll help others find this show. If you have any information related to this case, write or send a voice memo to hank@buriedtruths.org. Hank Klibanoff is a former newspaper reporter and editor and co-author of the Pulitzer Prize-winning book, The Race Beat. Today, he's a professor at Emory University. The Buried Truths team includes David Bereswain, Richard Hallix, Catherine Dautrick, Marilyn Gwax, J.N. Berry, and Christine Dempsey. Thanks to Emory University and its Centers for Digital Scholarship and Faculty Excellence. And another big thanks to the nearly 100 students who've taken the Civil Rights Cold Cases class that Hank Klibanoff teaches at Emory. And thank you for listening to Buried Truths.